appreciate Levi picking up the reading at the beginning of the chapter. I really do. I think it's important to be brought back and remember. It had kind of slipped my mind about Jesus being on the mountain in this whole presentation and how he worked his way through so many things trying to help his followers here. Having previously taken the idea of murder and kind of turned it upside down and pulled hate into the equation with verses 21 through 26 that Wes covered for us last week, Jesus now takes the idea of committing adultery and kind of takes that to a whole new level, similar in how he did with the idea of murder. And again, continuing to use that phrase, "You have heard it said," the idea of making reference to the Old Testament passages. I think it's important to point out that the text is all it's men referencing men lusting after women. But I think we all recognize that women can lust after and entice and men as well. So I wanted to point that out. The topic obviously is adultery, and some consider adultery the most devastating sin because of its effect on so many. The wife or the husband, the children, the extended family, the church. What a devastating sin adultery can be, is. I understand that Grant had the last question. So Trace, if you would, if you're up for question number one, what was the original Old Testament command that Jesus is referring to here in verse 27?
Well, as best I could tell, he directly quotes it from Exodus 20, verse 14, and also in Deuteronomy 5, verse 18. It's the seventh commandment, to not commit adultery. You shall not commit adultery.
Yeah, very good. Did anyone else have anything to add to that? Or?
I totally agree with that, what Trey said, but I think you could extend it all the way back to Genesis. There's not a specific command in Genesis, but the Lord creates one man and one woman, and they are joined together in one flesh. And so the suggestion there is that also marriage is for life, and that adultery also is forbidden with, you know, passage of time, it became a possibility. So it is the primary relationship, and it goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden, and really the Mosaic Law just codified what God established in the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good. That's right. Dennis?
Just in verse 17 of Exodus chapter 20, he kind of gives a glimpse of what we're going to say tonight about not coveting your neighbor's wife.
You know, right.
Looking,
right.
Have a desire for her.
Matt?
This is a textual thing, but in this passage and throughout this passage, we have this phrase, "You have heard it said," and then "to those of old" or "by those of old." A lot of scholars think that maybe that "to those of old" or "by those of old" was added, or it's not found in a lot of the early manuscripts, so it's better read just you've heard it said that you shall not commit adultery, not necessarily to those of old or by those of old, just one flowing sentence.
I remember that being pointed out in the group of verses having to do with murder, that same kind of point. Anyone else? Now, I found it interesting that under the old law, being caught in the act of adultery, Leviticus 20, verse 10, Deuteronomy 22, and verse 22, if convicted, you were stoned. It was addressed and taken care of right there. And as we know, many scriptures talk about sexual immorality, Old Testament and New Testament as well. Anyone else on question number one? If not, let's look at question number two. I had one other point. I almost missed it. I was got tucked in on my notes over there on the left-hand side. Years and years ago, there's probably just a few that might remember it. At the corner of Providence and Business Loop, where Moex is, facing to the southwest, I remember a billboard being there. I can't remember if it was a billboard, if it was the billboard that said parents tell, and that was crossed out, and it said show your children how important God is. Or it might have been that that said, what part of thou shalt don't you understand? So I kind of thought that might be a good time to kind of shoehorn that little point in there with this verse, thou shalt. And I can't remember which one of those texts were on that billboard, but okay, got it out of the way. Question number two, how is what Jesus said different from the original Old Testament command? Lauren?
Verses 19 and 20. Whoever therefore breaks the least, one of the least of these commandments and teaches men so shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. So it seems to me that Jesus is going through a couple of what seems to be very big commands here. He's talking from murder, now he gets to adultery. He drives, it's a thought that drives these crimes. It's not the action first, it's a thought that turns to the action. And so there's an attitude necessary to properly fulfill God's command. So through the Old Testament law, there was prohibitions against these actions. And Israel should have been able to deduce that by prohibiting these actions, the thoughts behind them should have been prohibited as well. You need to control your attitudes. Micah 6:8 says, he has shown you, O man, what is good. Do justly, love mercy, walk humbly with your God.
Very good. Yeah, very good. That was Micah 6:8?
Yeah.
Anyone else? Matt?
Certainly Jesus is getting at the motives here, as we talked about and as Lauren pointed out there. But I don't know that what he's saying is any different than what we find in the Old Testament. Look at, and this is more through example than it is through the direct commandment, because God says, you shall not do these actions, but once you get into the actual history, you see what happened to Samson when he lusted after somebody. You see what happened back in Genesis when Cain was angry with Abel and the favor that was shown to him by God. See what happens to David when he lusts after a woman. He ends up killing a man and committing adultery in that. And that is something that we can pull from the text. God doesn't say you shall not. Lusting after a woman is committing adultery. It doesn't say that in the Old Testament, but we see that that's where it's going to lead every time. You see it with Samson. You see it with David. You see it with other examples as well. So what Jesus is saying here is not necessarily different from what we see in the Old Testament. He's just cutting out the middleman of having to discern logically that's where this is going to lead. He says, this does lead here, and it's just as bad.
Yeah, that's good. Good. Very good. Wes?
And he says exactly that, I think. In Mark 7, verse 15, Jesus says, there's nothing that enters a man from outside which can defile him, but the things which come out of him, those are the things that defile a man. And then a few verses later, he says, what comes out of a man, that defiles a man. For from within, out of the heart of men, proceed evil thoughts, adulteries, fornication. Yeah. So, including the evil eye that we'll talk about in a minute. But the same argument, and tying together Lauren and Matt's thoughts, that it's the motivation that counts, but also the motivation causes the behavior, and it's all related, but it starts with what's in your heart.
Yeah, very good, very good.
And really, just to kind of add to what these guys were already saying, Solomon actually spells it out almost to a T in Proverbs chapter 6, verse 23, where he says, 23-29. The commandment is a lamp, and the law is light, and reproofs of instruction are the way of life, to keep thee from the evil woman, from the flattery of the tongue of a strange woman. Lust not after her beauty in thine heart, neither let her take thee with her eyelids, for by means of a whorish woman a man is brought to a piece of bread, and the adulteress will hunt for the precious life. Can a man take fire in his bosom, and his clothes not be burnt? Can one go upon hot coals, and his feet not be burnt? So he that goeth into his neighbor's wife, whosoever toucheth her, shall not be innocent. So he talks about here the dangers of the thought process itself, and he says to stop it right from the thought process, but he stops short of what Jesus says in the fact that they are both on equal planes by saying, whosoever touches her shall not be innocent. Jesus here is saying, no longer innocent far before you get to the physical act.
With the thought. Yeah, very good. Yeah, Dennis.
It's interesting, too, is Jesus here with these verses, as well as with the other ones about murder, says, you have heard, and I think he does this, he's really claiming the authority of God with these statements. It's just like as if he's saying, I, who am speaking to you, am the one who is responsible for giving the law to Moses, and I can therefore interpret it.
Yes.
So, just by implication, he's saying, I'm the one who, where it came from to begin with.
Yeah, good. Anyone else? Job 31 in verse 1 touches on the idea of, I made a covenant with my eyes. Why then shall I look upon a young woman? And then this reminds me of Adam and Eve in Genesis 3 verse 6. She allowed the serpent to bring these things out to where she looked upon the fruit and it was good, and the tree was beautiful, and you know the eyes. I read from several people that you know were pointing to the eyes and the power of the eyes and how they can lead us into trouble. Anyone else? One other thing, James chapter 1, verses 14 and 15 perfectly illustrate how someone is tempted through their eyes and desires and becomes enticed. Desire conceives and brings forth sin, and sin brings forth death. So, you know, we have Old Testament passages, we have New Testament passages, and several of these things talk about it. You know, Matt alluded to it. Grant, please.
Same idea in the next chapter. So the same teaching we see here in chapter 6, verses 22-23. The lamp of the body is the eye. If therefore your eye is good, your whole body will be full of light. If your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness.
Yeah, excellent. Very good. Anyone else? Question number 2. All right, let's look at question number 3. Is Jesus teaching unique New Testament doctrine or expanding, clarifying the meaning of the Old Testament? Halen?
As we've kind of already talked about, I feel like it's not anything new, but maybe it's expanding on it and kind of maybe a new way of looking at sin. Jesus, of course, is taking it further. As we've already talked about, he's getting at the intent of the heart and realizing that that is kind of where it starts at, the spark, if you will. Of course, the thought starts first, and then if you allow that to occur, then other things can occur. But if you stop right there, it can pretty much destroy the sin there.
Mm-hmm.
And so, we know that many times, looking can lead to lusting, and lusting can lead to adultery. As we've heard before, sin is a slippery slope. And like once you go down the path, it's really hard to, it's difficult to turn away from it. It gets harder and harder. So, that's pretty much all I have.
Yeah, no, that's good. Thank you. Anyone else on question number 3? More?
Dennis mentioned it a little bit ago about Exodus 20:17. You shall not covet your neighbor's house, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife, nor his male servant, nor his female servant, nor his ox, nor his donkey, nor anything else that is your neighbor's. So there was this prohibition against coveting another's wife before, but this would be a clarifying statement, in that it would separate the woman from the ox and the donkey and a man's property. Now, this desire is connected to adultery, not just the taking of another man's, you know, people at this time may have viewed the woman as the man's property, and this brings the woman, I think, to a little bit higher plane there.
Yeah, good point.
But it might also have driven, maybe to Bart's point, of the original intent of God, one man and one woman. Men at this time would see another woman and they would just add another wife. So it would also drive to that point. That's not acceptable.
Yeah, very good. Austin?
Somewhat of a confession to make. Actually had a little bit of a different understanding on kind of what's going on here in the Sermon on the Mount. And part of the reason I included this question, and I think I did in the last study as well, is because I kept thinking that it's either one or the other. That since it's in Matthew, that it has to only be New Testament doctrine. And that it can't have any shades of the old, and we can't say that it's Old Testament or clarifying. But if you look at it here, what Jesus is saying isn't contradicting the Old Testament. It flows perfectly within the old law. It expands upon it. It boosts it further, if you will. So he's not telling them things that the old law is prohibiting or would be against, that they, such that they would break the old law.
Mm-hmm.
But it's building upon that and showing them that there is a higher righteousness, if you will, than that of what the scribes and Pharisees were teaching.
I had that thought as well. And I looked at right here, verse 17. Jesus had just told them he came to fulfill the law. You know, we're not contradicting, we're not changing, not fulfilling. And then we're going to your point, we're going to take it further here. Yeah. Anyone else? Matt?
To build a little bit on what Austin said, I think he's totally right there, that sometimes maybe it's in the wave of debate, choosing sides, that causes us to do this, but we decide that something is either one way or the other, like Austin said, and we choose to look at it as it's either this way or it can't be that at all, and it's this other way. But when has God ever interacted that way? God is not one to make some sort of commandment, some sort of statute, and then say, "That never mind. It's not like that at all." The principle that God has is always going to be there. Now, he may change the way that that's manifested, or he may change the way that we look at it. But these principles that Jesus is putting forward here are not principles that God put in place to do away with. God put them in place in Israel in a very physical, you can see it, touch it, feel it, nature. And Jesus is saying, things are going to be different now, but these principles aren't going to be different. You still can't commit adultery. You still can't lie. You can't murder. But it's not going to be as easy to remember those things because there aren't physical manifestations and punishments that are going to be there. So you have to look farther inward here. And I appreciate what Austin said there, because it's not you don't draw a line and you're on one side or the other.
Mm-hmm.
This God is blending the Old Testament into the New Testament here. So he's not cutting it in half and it's one side or the other.
Being fulfilled. Yeah. Anyone else? All right. Again, back to James. Let's not forget James. Chapter 1, verse 12, blessed is the man, and I believe the woman, who endures temptation, for when he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life, which the Lord has promised to those who love him. All right, question number 4. What was the mental and spiritual dangers of engaging in the behavior Jesus is describing through methods like pornography? Bart, would you mind?
Well, I think the most serious and important one is separation from God. I thought about a brother who's been taking us through the book of Romans and how in Romans chapter 1, God gave them up to uncleanness and the lust of their hearts to dishonor their bodies among themselves, who exchanged the truth of God for the lie. And so the primary aspect of lusting and committing this sin is that it separates you from God. The wages of sin is death, and so we're separated from God for such a sin, and so we need to keep ourselves pure and stay close to God. But then I also thought about how sexual addictions have a more temporal and earthly and pervasive destructive influence in society, and we see that around us all the time. Sexual addiction is real tenacious, and it gets into someone's heart and soul and destroys really their ability to have relationships with others. It's counterfeit intimacy, really, is what it is. So it tricks the person into thinking that they're having intimacy in their life when they're not. And probably even more significantly than that, it devalues the person who is being objectified in the pornography is devalued. And so that person who's engaging and viewing this pornography develops a lower opinion of human beings. I think we see that going on in our culture. Women are devalued and seen as objects. And so it has both a spiritual and a temporal. I don't know if that's what Austin was exactly getting at, but that's kind of where I went. Uh-huh.
Good. Anyone else? I appreciate what you were saying about leading to other sinful behavior. I absolutely agree. The idea of seeing something that triggers a behavior is also a possibility. But when that happens, each of us have an opportunity to decide what we're going to do with that trigger. You know, we can control that. We can make those changes. The idea of hanging on to that thought or pushing it out of our mind with some other thought or some other action. Anyone else? About three times that you put your hand up the same time Austin had. Go ahead, Lauren.
For the I guess maybe the spiritual dangers of engaging in pornography, I thought about how that might make Christian men, if they were involved in this, unhappy with what they perceive of Christian women. And I thought of Nehemiah 13:25-27. So I contended with them and cursed them, struck some of them, and pulled out their hair and made them swear by God, saying, "You shall not give your daughters as wives to their sons, nor take their daughters for your sons or yourselves. Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin by these things? Yet among many nations there was no king like him. Yet he was beloved of his God, and God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, pagan women caused even him to sin. Should we then hear of you doing all this great evil, transgressing against their God by marrying pagan women?" So this is really kind of a desire to have a worldly relationship with a worldly woman, and that's not where we should be.
Yeah, that's a good point. Austin, you.
Yeah. Mark mentioned that of sexual addiction, and there's actually studies going on right now about the negative effects of pornography, and they're showing in the brain scans of those that are addicted that they are very close and mirror that of one who's a drug addict. It creates the same type of brain damage or brain consequence, I suppose, as one that would take a hard drug. Mm-hmm. So it's a very real problem. There's other studies about how frequent it is in the church, what they would describe as the church, something of 60% of those that profess to be Christian men have viewed pornography. I think it was somewhere in that range. I forget the exact number, but is a real problem.
Yeah.
So want to be certainly aware of it.
Anyone else? I found a quote from a writer named Carson, and he wrote, "Imagination is a God-given gift, but if fed dirt by the eye, it will be dirty. All sin, not the least sexual sin, begins with the imagination." So, again, we're talking about our eyes and what we see, what we feed our brain, our mind. Anyone else? Question number 5. Could what Jesus describes in verse 28 be considered grounds that one could pursue a divorce upon? Levi?
So we need to remember that Jesus is primarily talking about our accountability in the eyes of God. He's trying to emphasize that it's more like you need to also follow the... It's not just the words and the actions that you need to follow. You also need to have the mind behind it, too. And so if a man's throwing around thoughts in his head about killing someone, I mean, necessarily, with our judicial system, we're not going to kill him, you know. So I don't think it's very smart to say that it's, you know, legitimate grounds for divorce. Now, definite problem, yes, but I don't think that it's worth divorce.
Yeah, very well done. I agree with you. I thought it was a really tough question. For starters, that was a tough question. What are you doing, Austin?
Sorry.
Any other comments? Matt?
Well, the words, and words are important when we're talking about a semantic argument like this, the words used by the author here, and likely Jesus, if he was speaking Greek, he may not have been, but the author certainly was inspired to write in Greek, so we choose to take the Greek as inspired, and the word here in verse 28 is moikia, moikuyo, moikuo, there we go, and the word in verse 32 is porneia. These words have similar meaning, but porneia is used as it's much harsher throughout the New Testament. It is when you see the word sexual immorality all throughout Paul likes to use it in 1 Corinthians a lot. That word is porneia that's used there. It's the harsher term. It's not as vague as moikia. And if the words are different here, we have to at least consider that whatever's happening in verse 32, the porneia, is maybe not exactly the same as lusting is described in verse 28.
Yeah, I did a little bit of that, looking at some of these words, and felt like when I saw the passages where Jesus was condemning, that it was the porneia and more to the actual act. Anyone else here? Warren?
We're going back against to the argument on murder and the thought of hate behind it. We see that, you know, there is the judgment there is a God-given judgment. We have verses that kind of show that it's God that knows the heart. Psalm 139:1. O Lord, you've searched me and known me. Also Psalm 44:21. But not God searches out, for he knows the secrets of the heart. And so at this point, it seems to me we're really clarifying Old Testament law. And Old Testament law, Deuteronomy 17:6, there was a minimum of 2 witnesses required for the death penalty. And this adultery is a death penalty crime under the Old Testament law.
Right.
That same principle is brought forth in 1 Timothy 5:19. There's a minimum of 2 witnesses to receive accusation against an elder. So the standard of human judgment is evidence. that would be where, you know, in a divorce situation, that would be what we're looking at. And then kind of the match point, in 532, it says, except for sexual immorality or fornication, in different versions. Here the teaching is a high bar based on physical evidence for it.
Yeah. Yes?
Just thinking about 1 Corinthians 6:16, where it says, if you not know that he who is joined to her is one body with her, well, that sacred act of intimacy that's, you know, confined to marriage didn't take place. So, I mean, it's, as far as the difference, you know, the thought is still there. The person has the thought and the intent, the sinful thought. It's a sin between him and God now, but it didn't involve somebody else.
Right.
So it is, it's a sin, but it's not, I don't think, grounds for divorce or anything like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I got it muddied up a little bit for me when I think of a person that a spouse that's engaged in pornography and whatever else, and the other spouse comes upon them, but that's still between a husband and a wife. That's still a private thing. But it kind of threw a little wrinkle for me to think to challenge myself. Do I really think that this is? And the other thing I did, I went back to the murder, the group right before it, and you look in there where the outcomes are, we'll be in danger of judgment, in danger of judgment, shall be in danger of hellfire. So these weren't death penalty type of judgments involving having hate. It was compared to murder, but. I thought, well, maybe there's an aspect of it there where, you know, I didn't think that the adultery with your mind and your imagination, the idea of the question here would be grounds for divorce. So I went the path with the Levi was suggesting it. You know, tough question, but not grounds for divorce. Awesome.
100% agree with everything everyone has said. This is something I have heard of just in circles of people talking about people basically wanting a divorce. And they're trying to find grounds for which they can do it. We're going to talk about divorce next week, Lord willing. And sometimes we talk more about the exception than we do the rule. Because if you're going by the rule that it's for life, it's between one man and one woman, obviously I'm not married, but I would assume that you're going to try everything in your power to make sure that you maintain that, if you're interested at all in keeping the rule. And these questions come out of people hunting for the exception and not really being true to the rule itself.
I think that's a good point as well. Anyone else? Question number 5. All right, let's look at question number 6. What is the principle that Jesus is teaching? Is he promoting self-mutilation? This is verses 29 and 30. Logan?
No, I don't think so. I think there are two main teachings that I've gotten from these couple of verses here. Number one is the gravity of what he's talking about here. Uses this language to show how deadly sin is. Dad said earlier the wage of sin is death, so if you cut your hand off, you probably aren't going to die as long as you don't get an infection or something like that. So that's the first point there. The second point I thought about was, you know, he kind of lays the groundwork for a way of escape, as we see in 1 Corinthians here, chapter 10, verse 13. Well, temptation will also make the way of escape that you may be able to bear. So he's talking about cutting your arm off or cutting out your eye. And that has application to us in terms of what enables our sin. So if it's our location that enables our sin, if it's our habits or our possessions, we need to cut those out and get rid of them. We've been talking about pornography all night this evening, question 4, and the main enabler of pornography is the internet. So if you have the internet and that tempts you and causes you to sin, you just need to get rid of it.
Yeah, no, very good. I agree. Anyone else? Wes?
I got sort of tied up in Romans when I was studying this question, because Romans is so dense. And for me, at least, I have to read it very, very slowly to try to make sense of what Paul's writing there. But he addresses this exact issue, I think, several times throughout his writings. But in Romans 6, he talks about that we are baptized through Christ into death, and we are risen anew with him. And says in verse 11, likewise, reckon ye yourselves to be dead unto sin, but alive to God in Christ Jesus our Lord. Therefore, do not let sin reign in your mortal body, that you should obey it in its lusts. And then throughout the rest of that chapter and through chapter 7, he is sort of, to me, it seems like he's really trying to figure out all the ins and outs of this body versus mind sort of dual issue here. And so at the end of chapter 7, he says, for I delight in the law of God according to the inward man, but I see another law in my members, warring against the law of my mind and bringing me into captivity to the law of sin, which is in my members. O wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this body of death? I thank God through Jesus Christ our Lord. So then with the mind, I myself serve the law of God, but with the flesh, the law of sin. And so Paul's really at a battle with this idea of the, it actually says in verse 6 of chapter 7 too, that we serve in the newness of the Spirit and not in the oldness of the letter. Part of that newness is about, or most of it, is what we're talking about in Matthew 5, that it's the motivation, it's what's in your heart. And he's saying, well, I have good things in my heart and I'm trying, but my body sure makes it hard because there are so many ways to sin with your eye or to sin with your hand. And to sinning with the eye and plucking out your eye is related to thoughts and things we've been talking about. And then your hand is action. Mm-hmm. And so those two verses are saying, any thoughts or any actions, like Logan said, get them out of your life. And Paul's, you know, Paul's Paul, he's the Apostle Paul, and he's struggling with the same things we all do and saying, you can be as righteous as you want on the inside, but it's really hard because you have a body that's prone to sin and to tripping you up.
Yeah, nah, excellent, very good. Anyone else? Matt?
This is the one portion in this speech that seems to be almost totally figurative. The rest of it you can at least, in some way, if not completely, take it totally literally. And I think when we study this and the words of Jesus especially, because he switches back and forth so much from something that's literal and practical to something that is imagery. And we might do a disservice to ourselves sometimes to try to figure out if a passage, is this figurative or is it literal or should it be taken that way? Because it could be a little bit of both, and that's probably largely due to the Protestant influence on this country, because that's how Protestant theology works. It's either literal or it's figurative, and most of the time we need to take it as literally as we possibly can. That doesn't work here. And we need to understand that the way that we interpret things is not necessarily the way that they were written. And sometimes things are figurative, sometimes they're literal, and sometimes they're blended right together, and Jesus does that a lot.
Yeah, good. Anyone else? Yeah, Austin.
I got to thinking about kind of the how it would look if you were to talk to someone who had actually cut off their hand or had actually gouged out their eye and said, well, anyone would say, what happened? Well, I had a sin that I couldn't stop doing, so I had to cut my hand off. And in our minds, that would look foolish. And I think part of the idea here is obviously we have control over our hands, we have control over our eyes, and that's part of what he's talking about here. Sometimes you have to cut off something within yourself that may look foolish, it may bring reproach upon you in that present moment, it may be a sign of weakness or whatever it is, but it's better to have that than to spend an eternity in hell because you were too proud or you didn't want to give up a relationship or whatever the case might be. Whatever it was that was holding you back, that was causing you to sin, that you refused to give up because of how it might look or how people might take it, It's better to suffer the foolishness of what it might look like to other people than to spend an eternity in regret.
Okay. Yeah, good. Anyone else? I got one more quote. Bear with me. Guy named Trapp this time. When one seemed to pity a one-eyed man, he told him he'd lost one of his enemies, a thief, that would have stolen away his heart. Anyone else? Closing comments.